A Heavy Weight is intended for mature audiences. This series discusses topics that may be triggering to some listeners, such as suicide and drug use. Some names in this series have been changed to protect identities. Views expressed by guests on this series are their own and may not reflect my own. Resources and source materials can be found on our website, aheavyweight.com. Thank you so much for listening. This is episode 6 of A Heavy Weight, a podcast reinvestigating the disappearance of Joseph Smedley. Last episode left off as the investigation into Joseph's death had just begun. Joseph had vanished after leaving his apartment on Sunday, September 27, 2015, and his body was recovered from Griffey Lake on the evening of Friday, October 2nd. While Joseph's disappearance was initially handled by the Indiana University Police Department, it was transferred to the Bloomington Police Department once his body was found outside of IUPD's jurisdiction. Once BPD took over Joseph's case, the dynamics between Joseph's family and law enforcement were strained. Shortly after Joseph's body was recovered, a vigil was held at Indiana University on Wednesday, October 7th, for both Joseph and Yaolin Wang. I mentioned Yaolin in an earlier episode. The week of Joseph's disappearance, Yaolin was murdered. She'd been a junior at IU. Vivian traveled from Indianapolis down to Bloomington to attend the vigil. It was during that trip that she was able to sit down with BPD officers and share all the information she'd learned about her brother's life and movements leading up to his disappearance. It was the first time she'd been able to meet with officers since identifying her brother's body on October 2nd. Vivian met with BPD Lieutenant Brad Seifers and shared an electronic file she'd created that contained all of the pertinent information she'd uncovered. According to Vivian, Lieutenant Seifers glanced through everything she shared and assured her he'd be in touch soon. She waited patiently for updates about her brother's case, but it took BPD officers nearly 6 weeks to get back to her. And once they did, the call wasn't what she expected. Instead of an update on the case, they asked her for her father's phone number so that the lieutenant could set up a time to meet with Joe Sr. to bring him up to speed.
So we just went on pins and needles and, like, at this time, I didn't even know my dad was involved because he's just been out of Joseph's life for so long.
It was at this point in time, around November 20th in 2015, that Joe Sr. was named the main point of contact for BPD's case. He became the only person they would release information to. Because they don't have the time or resources to go over information with multiple family members or people related to a case, it's not uncommon for detectives to name a single point of contact during an investigation. The interesting part, from my perspective, was that BPD chose Joe Sr. instead of Vivian. At the end of last week's episode, we heard from Joe Sr. after he'd had this initial meeting with BPD. The prevailing theory being presented by law enforcement and the media was that Joseph had likely died by suicide, and that no foul play was suspected. Given what Vivian and her father knew, they both felt that there were big pieces of information missing, and that the story being presented didn't seem logical. They weren't getting any clear answers to the questions they were asking.
You expect this kid to walk in the dark around 4 a.m., probably 5, to get to from one side of campus to the other, which would have taken like an hour, and drive, and then like walk down this dark like street in the woods, get down to Griffey Lake with no coat or anything because he just had sweatshirt on and pants and backpack, find some rocks in the pitch black dark because it's like there's no lights, and there's about a mile long that you have before you get to the lake, and there's barely any lights at the lake.
Considering Joseph's cell phone pings, the chain of events doesn't make sense unless he was driving or being driven from place to place. And from the start, Joseph's family never believed Joseph died by suicide. But it's not just his family who don't believe it. His friends also don't buy it. Especially those closest to him, like his friend Jess.
I don't think he committed suicide. I really do not. But I really don't know what happened. I mean, yeah, I don't think he did. And like, I remember hearing like he had made plans like later that week. And then I know he was like telling Viv that he was going to pay rent to her or something like that. Like, I don't see him like leaving and putting her in like a vulnerable position where she has to like pay his rent, and him like just being like, well, don't care anymore. And like, yeah, none of it adds up. I really don't think he did something to himself.
I still haven't found a single friend, family member, or acquaintance who could speak to Joseph struggling with his mental health leading up to his disappearance. A history of depression or suicidal ideation are not absolute criteria for making a death by suicide determination, but they are things that would support that theory. Not only that, but Joseph was actively making plans with people for the upcoming week the night he disappeared. And it's one of those things Joseph's friends and family have never been able to make sense of.
His text messages from that Sunday when he disappeared were saying, or reaching out to people for, and making plans for the rest of the week. He was talking to girls about a party they were having on Thursday, trying to get them to come to this party. And it's like, okay, if you're suicidal on that day, you're not thinking about making plans to go to a party that week. You're thinking about how I'm going to get to Griffey Lake in the middle of the night and jump in the water. Like, that's pretty much going to consume your day and your thoughts. But he was talking to some girl all the way up until like 11 o'clock. He was making plans with her too. So it's just like, if at what point would he have just decided that, you know, he wants to go put rocks in his backpack and jump in the water, you know, between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., he decides that's what he wants to do. Like, it just doesn't make any sense.
It's also important to convey that a lot of people close to Joseph were never interviewed or questioned by police. Like his friend Jess, despite being one of his closest friends and having spent most of the weekend leading up to his disappearance with him.
I think it was who said when he called me on that Monday saying, like, have you heard it from him? Like, I think he was the one that said, oh, the police might call you just to talk to you. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Give him my information. Like, I'm happy to talk to him. But yeah, I was never spoken to or anything.
The name you heard obscured is the real name of one of Joseph's roommates, the person we've been referring to as Josh. Based on the evidence, it's understandable why detectives would be focused on the theory of death by suicide. There was the strange text to Vivian's phone, the note found by his roommates, and the missing bottle of scotch. But is that enough to determine manner of death without talking to those who were closest to him?
I don't think that they really suspected that it was a foul play, just by the way that they had conducted some of the interviews with the roommates and things like that. So I really think that they might have thought that it was a suicide all along.
How do we know that Joseph sent that text to his sister's phone? How do we know he wrote the note found by his roommates? Where did the rocks in his backpack come from? How could he have gotten to Griffey Lake at 4 a.m., and why? Who could have been with him that night?
The only reason that I could think of is that he said, okay, well, it's a blood moon and we can get a good view of it from the lake. So I could see everybody going down to the lake, him having his binoculars with him since they were found around his neck, and wanting to get a good glimpse, you know, and kind of treat it like a celebration or something. Like, he just was really into that stuff. So, I mean, if something could have happened while they were down there, but, I mean, I know he wasn't alone. It's just virtually impossible for him to be completely by himself at that lake in the dark. I mean, in order to be at that lake, he would have had to have transportation. And there's no Lyft or a bus ticket or anything that's been purchased on his transactions. And looking through the chat with the GroupMe, the fraternity brothers are definitely familiar with Griffey Lake. They sound like they went there frequently. I've also heard it's kind of a party spot. And they mentioned taking their pledges down there a couple of times.
Griffey Lake is a 109-acre lake within a 1,200-acre nature preserve in the northern part of Bloomington. It's a popular spot for hiking, boating, and fishing. The city's Parks and Recreation Department manages a small boat rental and marina near the southeast portion of the lake. You can rent paddle boats, canoes, kayaks, or rowboats, and it's a popular location for students to hang out. As you drive down to enter the marina parking lot, you cross a bridge that's roughly 10 feet above the water. It's near this bridge that Joseph's body was found. I've marked the area on a map of the lake that you can see on our website. It's a place you're likely to see folks fishing by the side of the road. It's a place you'd have to drive to unless you lived in a nearby neighborhood. With no sidewalks, steep inclines, and winding turns, the roads leading into the boat rental area are unsafe for walking, and they're surrounded by woods. It would be an especially dangerous walk at night, as there aren't any street lamps to light the way. When Joe Sr. first met with law enforcement, they told him that based off of the text, the handwritten note, and the missing scotch bottle, they believed that Joseph had taken his own life. Their theory was that Joseph somehow got himself to Griffey Lake, filled his backpack with rocks, and jumped from the bridge on the road, landing in the water below, where his body stayed submerged for 5 days before rising due to his body releasing gases after death. But the water Joseph was found in wasn't very deep. It was so shallow, he could have stood up and had his head above water. Joe Sr. wasn't satisfied with this theory. Based on the information that was presented to him, he couldn't rule out foul play. This feeling only intensified once Joseph's autopsy and toxicology reports came in. It was mid-November when Joe Sr. first became the main point of contact that he and Vivian finally received what they'd been waiting for, the autopsy and toxicology reports. But unfortunately, the reports left them with even more questions. I'm not going to get into the specifics of the reports in this episode, and when I do, I'll have a forensic pathologist go over the findings and what they could mean. For now, I'm just going to give you an overview. The autopsy report reads, information provided by the detectives indicate that the subject was discovered floating in shallow water by a fisherman the evening of October 2, 2015. A backpack was strapped tightly around the chest, containing an estimated 30 pounds. There's a note to correct the amount to 30 kilograms of large rocks, as well as writing instruments and charging cords. The last known contact was early the morning of September 28, 2015. A note was present in his apartment indicating intent to leave the country. Suspicions were raised about illegal drug use. Findings consistent with drowning. No evidence of trauma. The toxicology panel, based on the right pleural putrefactive fluid, indicates moderately severe alcohol intoxication. and presumed under the influence of THC. The hallucinogen DMT is not detected. Toxicology findings are interpreted as contributory to the cause of death by drowning. Relentless and determined are two words that come up in my interviews time and time again when those close to Joseph describe him.
So I know that he had a tough life in certain aspects, but the fact that people would think that he would commit suicide is just not his personality, because of the fact that he had such a bad experience was the reason that I felt like was driving him in the first place. And I felt like, you know, he wanted to prove my father wrong. He wanted to prove my stepmother wrong. He wanted to prove everyone wrong who thought, you know, he wasn't anything. And, I just remember talking to him. He was constantly getting interviews for positions at, you know, labs and stuff like that. Like, he was moving forward in his life. So I just know for a fact that, you know, even though there are a lot of tough things that happen to us, doesn't mean that would be something that I would feel he would want to end his life. I feel like that only empowered him more.
Joseph's family acknowledges that he had a difficult life. Joseph was open about that, and it was a big source of what motivated him as he began college life. His sister Giselle agrees.
He was in such a toxic situation for so long that, like, I mean, this kid endured so much, you know? Mm-hmm. And me just being, like, kind of an outsider looking in and, like, seeing everything that was going on, like, mm-hmm. Of course, I was kind of sheltered from a lot of the situations, but just seeing everything that, like, my siblings would go through, that I feel like him getting to campus would have been, like, a relief, you know? Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't have been more stress. It was, like, finally, like, I'm out of, you know, this toxic relationship, so mm-hmm. with my family and stuff like that. So I feel like for him, getting there, which to me I would have viewed it as like finally he's free, you know, mm-hmm. getting there and then giving up doesn't make any sense. And then another thing that really just blew my mind was that literally in his social media bios it says like that he did not commit suicide.
It's true. Joseph's Twitter bio reads, IU undergraduate, biochemistry, pre-farm. If found dead in police custody, it wasn't suicide, and I don't want peaceful protests. This bio has been something that people point to say that perhaps Joseph was involved in something potentially life-threatening and that he knew his life may have been in danger. I can't speak for him, and I also have to consider this bio in the context of when it was written in 2015. In July of 2015, Sandra Bland, a black woman, was pulled over for failing to signal a lane change. She was arrested during this traffic stop, and 3 days after her arrest, she was found hanged in her jail cell. Her death was ruled a suicide. The ruling sparked protests nationwide as video footage of her arrest was shared with the public. Many people to this day dispute this, alleging her death was caused by racial profiling and white violence. Her arrest was violent, and in the years since her case, there have been dozens more like it. Black men and women whose lives were taken by racism and police violence. As a young black man, Joseph knew firsthand what it means to be living in the United States, within a society that upholds white supremacist ideologies. He knew that danger. Since 2015, we've only seen more and more devastating cases like Sandra's emerge. We can't look at Joseph's case or tell his story without acknowledging racial bias in policing. There's no doubt in my mind that Joseph's case was treated differently because of the color of his skin. Which brings me back to Joe Sr.'s suspicion that his son may have been a confidential informant. Of all the questions I've gone through related to this theory, I keep coming back to this. Both Vivian and Joe Sr. clearly remember IUPD detectives noting that they knew Joseph was involved with drugs. How likely is it that police officers would know a young black man was involved with drugs, possibly dealing as well as using, on a prominent college campus and just look the other way? Joe Sr. recalls talking to his cousins about that very question.
And this was ironic. And she called me and she said, "Did you see that 60 Minutes report on this issue about confidential informants, college students?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you might, Google it and see if you can watch it." I did. And it blew me out the water because there was an investigative reporter in Florida and an attorney in Florida got together. And what they discovered was that across the United States, almost all college campuses, there's a phenomenon that goes on whereby if they bust a kid with drugs, they force them to be a confidential informant. By forcing, I mean, they bring the kid in, and you know how police talk, they get pretty rough. And they say, "Look, he might have had a joint or something, And so they say, "All right, you're in college, your parents are paying for your college. We want you to wear a wire, and or we want you to lead us to the person that sold you the drugs." Okay. And it scared the kid, say, either you do that or we go public and your parents know and you're out of school, that whole kind of thing. Your college education is over. That's common. State, coast to coast. And so I looked at that. And then I looked at the fact that the IU police chief, IU Bloomington, IU campus police chief said that they knew Joseph was selling drugs. Mm-hmm. And then when the last time we went down there to talk to her again, she said, "Well, everything's been turned over to Bloomington police now."
Yeah.
After our investigation is over, everything's been turned over to them. Mm-hmm. So I did a little bit more research and I found out that Bloomington police has done that.
I mentioned Andrew Sadek's case last episode. Back in 2015, CBS News aired a 60-minute segment about Andrew's case, and that's the case that Joe is referring to. Andrew Sadek was a college student in North Dakota who'd been caught selling small amounts of marijuana. In 2013, he sold a small amount to another student who was already working as a confidential informant, after which his dorm room was searched. To put this in perspective, Andrew first sold the CI an eighth of an ounce or 3.5 grams for $60, and then sold the CI 1 gram for $20. When his dorm was searched, a grinder was found with marijuana residue. Andrew wasn't charged or arrested for this, but instead met with a deputy sheriff the following day, who informed Andrew that because he had sold marijuana on a college campus, he could be facing up to 40 years in prison. Andrew was then coerced into becoming a CI himself to avoid being charged with a Class A felony and face hefty fines, as he was told could happen. He made a few small controlled buys on campus under advisement of law enforcement, and a few months after he first became a CI, Andrew left his apartment late one night and disappeared. His body was found about 2 months after he disappeared by a dive team doing a training exercise in Red River in Minnesota. Andrew's cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head. It could not be determined whether the gunshot wound was self-inflicted or not. He was found weighed down by a backpack full of rocks. Andrew's family has never believed he died by suicide, but believe his death was due to his being a CI. While there are a lot of differences in their cases, there's enough in common to draw some eerie parallels. And here's the thing about becoming a CI. Unless you're charged with a crime, law enforcement doesn't have to inform you of your Sixth Amendment right to speak to an attorney. In 2015, very few places in the U.S. had any consistent policies about CIs. Andrew's story reinforced Joe Sr.'s theory that his son may have been used as a CI. After all, IUPD detectives allegedly admitted that they knew Joseph was involved with drugs.
Okay, so there's some other things that was happening. We met with the chief of police. It was a woman of the Bloomington Police Department. She told us, my wife and I, they were aware of Joseph and they were aware of his activities. And she said that they were aware that Joseph had been selling in some small quantities of like marijuana to maybe some frat brothers or something. And, but they said, we know he's not a drug dealer, you know, but we are aware that he's, you know, done this. So I said, okay. And they had a file on him that they refused to let us see. I take that back. My wife looked through it, and but they wouldn't let us take anything from the file or make us any copies. So so that raised another red flag.
Joe Sr. refers to a chief of police at BPD, but who he's actually referring to is Rebecca Schmiel of IUPD, who led the initial investigation when Joseph was first reported missing. Remember that Vivian had uncovered a lot of chatter among Joseph's fraternity brothers about alleged drug deliveries on the group chat she'd found on her brother's laptop. Both Andrew and Joseph were young college students doing well in school. They both left their apartments late one night with no one seeing or hearing anything. And they both ended up in a body of water with a backpack full of rocks tied to them. How do you determine whether or not a backpack full of rocks was intended to aid a death by suicide or to conceal a body? If the water Joseph was found in was so shallow he could have stood up and had his head clear the water, how likely is it that he died by suicide? At this point in Joseph's story, it's time to pull in a few experts who can speak to the likelihood of Joseph being a CI and the specifics of his cause and manner of death. First, I spoke with Amelia Lawn, a local attorney in Bloomington.
Yeah, so my name's Amelia Lawn, and I'm born and raised in Bloomington. It's one of those classic things where my parents came here for my mom to go to law school and then just never left. And I've been an attorney since 2010.
Amelia's focus is working with university students at IU.
Basically, my focus, as you said, is mainly helping students through cases, whether it's there's overlap where cases happen at IU and in the criminal justice system. For example, someone has a joint in their dorm room. That's both criminal and a violation of IU's code. And then I also help students who are complainants within the system. For example, someone who's experienced a sexual assault, things like that.
Since Amelia has worked with a lot of college students attending IU, I wanted to know if she'd come across any cases where students had been used as CIs.
I have come across that before, where students have been used as CIs. And I can't say, I can't remember if it was IUPD or BPD, which agency it was, but I know that that students sometimes are CIs.
As Joe Sr. said, there have been cases of CIs at IU's Bloomington campus. So he filed a request for information with the FBI, stating that he and his wife believed that Joseph may have been a CI. Their request outlined how they had come to this conclusion. The complaint synopsis reads, Complaint of Alleged Corruption Regarding Death Investigation of Joseph Smedley Jr. by Indiana University Police Department and Bloomington Police Department. A victim specialist at the FBI responded to the complaint with this information. On May 6, 2016, IUPD was contacted regarding Joseph Smedley II. Their records indicate there was limited interaction with Mr. Smedley. There were no indications of any drug investigation on or related to him. And there were no indications that he was being used as a source of any kind. The only records related to Mr. Smedley were regarding him as a suspect of a burglary on campus earlier in the year. During the death investigation, it was discovered that he matched the description of the person on video surveillance, and he had one of the stolen items in his possession. BPD was contacted on May 6, 2016, and their records indicate their only interaction with Mr. Smedley was a traffic stop in 2014. There were no indications of any drug investigations on or related to him, and there were no indications that he was being used as a source of any kind. The death investigation conducted by BPD led them to believe that the manner of death was suicide. There were no indications that foul play was involved in the death, or that anyone else was involved in the death. The FBI reply was brief and basically indicates that a victim specialist contacted the Bloomington Police Department and IUPD, who then informed them of what I just read to you. I can't say that the FBI's response changed my mind about the possibility of Joseph being a CI. If anything, it shows that if law enforcement doesn't want information about a case released, there's nothing to compel them to do so. Another reason I can't rule out the CI theory is because of what Joseph's autopsy and toxicology reports tell us. But that's next time on A Heavy Weight.
I'll say that in all my autopsies since 2015, I've never ordered it once. So, not common.
Less than 5% of bodies are found face up on the surface.
They wanted to see if there was some hallucinogenic compound in his system which may have produced unusual behavior.
I should actually say body reportedly found in water, because sometimes they weren't even in the water, it was just all staging.
Heavy Weight is written, produced, and hosted by me, Stacey Brodovsky. Edited and engineered by Joseph Caldwell. Additional editing, music, and sound design by Mike Brodovsky.